crimes attributed to him is as painful to me as if he were my son, the brother I lost, a man as close to me in many ways as anyone I have ever known. There will never be a time in my life when I will not think of him. I have felt friendship, love, respect, anxiety, sorrow, horror, deep anger, despair, and at the end, resigned acceptance of what has to be. Like John Henry Brown and Peggy Good, like his mother and the women who loved him romantically, I have tried to save Ted's life, twice. Once he knew it, and once he didn't. He received the letter I mailed in 1976 when I begged him not to kill himself. But he never knew that I had tried to arrange a plea bargain in 1979 that might have meant confinement in a mental hospital instead of the trials that led him inexorably toward the electric chair. And like all the others, I have been manipulated to suit Ted's needs. I don't feel particularly embarrassed or resentful about that. I was one of many, all of us intelligent, compassionate people who had no real comprehension of what possessed him, what drove him obsessively. Ted came into my life, however peripherally, at a time when all the beliefs I had held smugly for many years had been shattered. True love, marriage, fidelity, selfless motherhood, blind trust. All those marvelous truths were suddenly only wisps of smoke blowing away in a totally unforeseen gust of wind. But Ted seemed to embody what was young, idealistic, clean, sure, and empathetic. He seemed to ask nothing but friendship. He was, in 1971, a decisive factor in the verification that I was a person of worth, a woman who still had a great deal to give and to reap. He was most assuredly not a predatory male eager to hit on a newly divorced woman. He was simply there, listening, reassuring, giving credibility to what I was trying to become. Such a friend is not easy to turn one's back on. I have no idea what I was to him, what I seemed to remain to him. Perhaps I only gave back to him what he had given to me. I saw him then as quite perfect, and he must have needed that. Perhaps he could sense an emotional strength in me, although I surely did not feel it myself at the time. He may have known that he could count on me when the going grew perilous for him. In times of deepest stress, he would turn to me again and again. And I did attempt to help him, but I could never really assuage his pain because Ted could never bring himself to expose the soft underbelly of his anguish. He was a shadow man, fighting to survive in a world that was never made for him. It must have taken incredible effort. The parameters of that shadow man were constructed with such care, one misstep and they could all come apart. The Ted Bundy the world was allowed to see was handsome, his body honed and cultivated meticulously, a barrier of strength against eyes that might catch a glimpse of the terror inside. He was brilliant, a student of distinction, witty, glib, and persuasive. He loved to ski, sail, and hike. He favored French cuisine, good white wine, and gourmet cooking. He loved Mozart and obscure foreign films. He knew exactly when to send flowers and sentimental cards. His poems of love were tender and romantic. And yet in reality, Ted loved things more than he loved people. He could find life in an abandoned bicycle or an old car and feel a kind of compassion for these inanimate objects, more compassion than he could ever feel for another human being. Ted could and did rub elbows with the governor, travel in circles that most young men could never hope to enter, but he could never feel good about himself. On the surface, Ted Bundy was the very epitome of a successful man. Inside, it was all ashes. For Ted has gone through life terribly crippled, like a man who is deaf or blind or paralyzed. Ted has no conscience. Conscience doth make cowards of us all, but conscience is what gives us our humanity, the factor that separates us from animals. It allows us to love, to feel another's pain, and to grow. Whatever the drawbacks are to being blessed with a conscience, the rewards are essential to living in a world with other human beings. The individual with no conscience, with no superego at all, has long been a focal point for study by psychiatrists and psychologists. The terms used to describe such an individual have changed over the years, but the concept has not. Once it was called a psychopathic personality, and then it became sociopath. Today, the term in vogue is antisocial personality. To live in our world, with thoughts and actions always counter to the flow of your fellow men, must be an awesome handicap. There are no innate guidelines to follow. The psychopath might well be a visitor from another planet, struggling to mimic the feelings of those he encounters. It is almost impossible to pinpoint just when antisocial feelings begin, although most experts agree that emotional development has been arrested in early childhood, perhaps as early as 3. Usually, the inward turning of emotions results from a need for love or acceptance not filled, from deprivation and humiliation. Once begun, that little child will grow tall, but he will never mature emotionally. He may experience pleasure on only a physical level, an excitable high, and a sense of euphoria from the games he substitutes for real feelings. He knows what he wants, and because he is not hampered by guilt feelings or the needs of others, he can usually achieve instant gratification. But he can never fill up the lonesome void inside. He is insatiable, always hungry. The antisocial personality is mentally ill, but not in the classic sense or within our legal framework. He is invariably highly intelligent and has long since learned the proper responses, the tricks and techniques that will please those from whom he wants something. He is subtle, calculating, clever, and dangerous, and he is lost. Dr. Benjamin Spock, who worked in a veterans hospital dealing with emotional illnesses during World War II, commented at the time that there was a pronounced cross-sex problem in dealing with psychopathic personalities. The male psychopaths had no difficulty in bewitching female staff members, while the male staff picked up on them rapidly. The female psychopaths could fool the male staff, but not the women. Ted's retinue of friends and companions was always heavily weighted with women. Some loved him as a man. Some women, like myself, were drawn to his courtly manners, his little boy quality, his seemingly genuine concern and thoughtfulness. Women were always Ted's comfort and his curse. Because he could control women, balance us carefully in the tightly structured world he had manufactured, we were important to him. We seemed to hold the solution to that dead, hollow place inside him. He dandled us as puppets from a string, and when one of us did not react as he wanted, he was both outraged and confused. I believe men, on the other hand, were a threat. The one man whom he felt he could emulate, the man whose genes and chromosomes dictated who he was, had been left behind. When Ted told me for the first time about his illegitimate birth, I sensed that he seemed to consider himself a changeling child, the progeny of royalty dumped by mistake on the doorstep of a blue-collar family. How he loved the thought of money and status, and how inadequate he felt when he found himself with women who were born to it. Ted never really knew who he was supposed to be. He'd been taken away from his real father, and then taken away from his grandfather Cowell, whom he loved and respected. He could not, would not, use Johnny Culpepper Bundy as a role model. I think his feelings toward his mother were marked with a raging ambivalence. She had lied to him. She had robbed him of his real father, although rational consideration shows that she had no choice. But half of Ted was gone, and he would spend the rest of his life trying to make up for that loss. Still, he clung to his mother, tried to live up to her dreams that he must excel, that he was her special child who could do anything. Of all the women that Ted was involved with romantically, it was Meg Anders who lasted the longest, and it was Meg who was the most like Louise Bundy. Both of them are small, almost frail women, and each was left alone with a child to raise. Each of them traveled far from their family homes to start a new life with that child. Meg Anders and Louise Bundy are the two women who, I believe, suffered the most agony when Ted's facade shattered. The men that Ted was drawn to were all men of power, either through their accomplishments, their intellect, or their easy mantle of masculinity. His lawyer friend in Seattle, Ross Davis, head of the Washington State Republican Party, John Henry Brown, the dynamic public defender, John O'Connell, his Salt Lake City attorney, Buzzy Ware, the brilliant Colorado attorney he lost, Millard Farmer, denied to him by the Florida courts. Policemen had that same kind of power, especially Norm Chapman of Pensacola, who exuded strength, masculinity, and yes, the ability to love. Like a little boy who yearns to be important, to be noticed, Ted played perverse games with policemen. In many of his crimes, he would assume their mantle, their badges, and he would, for that time, be one of them. Although he often called policemen stupid, he needed to know that he was important to them, if only in a negative sense. If he could not please them, then he would displease them so much that he had to be noticed. He had to be so notorious that all other criminals would pale in comparison. It is interesting to consider that when Ted confessed his escape and his intricate credit card thefts, when he discussed his terrible fantasies, it was to policemen. His voice on the tapes made in Pensacola is excited and full of pride. He is triumphant and in his element on those tapes, doing exactly what he wants to be doing as if he were laying a gift before them, expecting praise for his cunning. Those detectives were men who could appreciate his cleverness. And, as he said, "I'm in charge of entertainment." I have no doubt that Ted would have given anything in the world to have been able to change places with big, easygoing Norm Chapman. Because that man, whatever his limitations, knew who he was, and Ted never had. Women were easier to deal with, but women held the power to hurt and humiliate. Stephanie Brooks was the first to hurt him badly. Although Ted had dated only infrequently in high school, he had longed for a relationship with a woman who was beautiful and wealthy. Stephanie did not make Ted an antisocial personality. She exacerbated what was already smoldering there. When she walked away from him after their first year together, he was ashamed and humiliated, and the rage he felt was out of all proportion. He was a little boy again, a boy who had had a toy wrenched away from him, and he wanted it back. True, he would smash it and the relationship when he got it back, but he had to have the opportunity to do that. It took him years, but Ted did accomplish the seemingly impossible task of reworking the outer Ted until he was able to meet Stephanie's standards for a potential husband. Then he could humiliate her just as she had humbled him, and he did. Once she had promised to marry him, he changed suddenly and sent her away. He put her on the airplane to California without so much as a kiss, saw her stunned face, and turned his back on her. But it didn't seem to be enough. His revenge brought no lessening of the void in his soul, and it must have been a terrible realization for him. He had worked, planned, schemed so that he could reject Stephanie, sure that he would feel whole and serene again, and yet he still felt empty. He still had Meg. And Meg loved him devotedly, would have married him in a minute. But Meg was too much like Louise. Any love he felt for either of them was tempered with scorn for their weakness. Somehow he would have to punish Stephanie more. It was, of course, only 3 days after Stephanie left Seattle in January of 1974 that Joni Lenz was bludgeoned and raped symbolically with a metal bedrod as she lay sleeping in her basement room. And so the answer to the question put to me so many times is yes. Yes, I believe Ted Bundy attacked Joni Lenz, just as I now am forced to believe that he is responsible for all the other crimes attributed to him. I have never said it out loud or in print, but I believe it, as devoutly as I wish I did not. The victims are all prototypes of Stephanie. The same long hair parted in the middle, the same perfectly even features. None of them were random choices. I think some of them were chosen, watched for long periods before the attacks occurred, while others were picked rapidly because they were convenient targets during those times when Ted was in the grip of his maniacal compulsion. But they all resembled Stephanie, the first woman who had pierced Ted's carefully constructed facade and revealed the yawning vulnerability beneath. That damage to Ted's ego could never be forgiven. None of the crimes filled the emptiness. He had to keep killing Stephanie over and over again, hoping that each time would be the time that would bring surcease. But the more there were, the worse it became. Ted had said that, "My fantasies are taking over my life," and I don't believe that he had any control over them. The compulsion that he excoriated in his first letter to me after his arrest in Pensacola dominated Ted. Ted did not dominate the compulsion. He could manipulate other people, but God help him, he could not stop himself. He also said that acting out his fantasies was a downer, and the depths of those downers can only be imagined by a rational mind. Since an antisocial personality has no empathy at all for others, it was not his victim's pain that tormented him. It was that there was no relief for him. All of his victims were so lovely, so carefully chosen, that during the time they were living players in his obsessive rituals, he thought he cared for them. The rituals themselves left the chosen limp, bleeding, and ugly. Why did it have to be that way? He detested them for dying, for becoming ugly, for leaving him again alone. And in the midst of the awful aftermath of the fantasies, he could not truly comprehend that it was he who had wrought the destruction. Madness, yes, but madness is what I am trying to understand. Holding the reins of power was no fun when there was no one left to terrorize with that power. I think the rest of the carefully regimented games came about accidentally, an extension of the killing games. Driven by rage, revenge, frustration, Ted killed. The sexual aspect of the murders was not a matter of satiating his drives, but rather the need to humiliate and demean his victims. He felt no true sexual release, only the blackest of depressions. It was only after the killings that Ted realized just how newsworthy he was. He began to exult in the thrill of the chase, and it became a part of the ritual, a part even more satisfying than the murders themselves. His power over the dead girls lasted such a short time, but his power over the police investigators went on and on. That he could do these things, take more and more chances, refine his disguises so that he could come out in the light of day and still remain undetected, was the ultimate euphoria. He could do what no other man could do, and do it with impunity. How often he would talk to me of being in the limelight, being the golden boy. It became life and breath to him. And the games became more intricate. When Ted was finally arrested in Utah in 1975 by Sergeant Bob Hayward, he was outraged. One must understand that he actually felt this sense of indignation. As an antisocial personality, he could feel no guilt. He had only taken what he wanted, what he needed to feel whole. He was incapable of understanding that one cannot fulfill his own desires at the expense of others. He had not finished with the games, and the stupid police had ended them before he was ready. When Ted complained throughout the years about jails, prisons, the courts, the judges, the district attorneys, the police, and the press, he was not aware that there was another side to it all. His reasoning was simplistic, but to him it made sense. What Ted wanted, Ted should have, and there was the blind spot in his superior intelligence. When he wept only for himself, but his tears were real tears. He was desperate and afraid and angry, and he believed that he was completely within his rights. To convince him otherwise would be akin to explaining the theory of relativity to a kindergarten child. The mechanisms needed to understand the needs and rights of others are not integrated into his thinking processes. Even today, I cannot hate him for that. I can only feel profound pity. Ted has often bragged to me that psychiatrists and psychologists could find nothing abnormal about him. He had masked his responses, another red flag indicator of the antisocial personality. Dr. Herve Kleckley, the Augusta, Georgia psychiatrist who interviewed Ted prior to his Miami trial, the evaluation that Ted felt he was tricked into, is an expert on the antisocial personality, and he acknowledges that standard tests seldom reveal this aberration. The observer is confronted with a convincing mask of sanity. We are not dealing with a complete man at all, but with something that suggests a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly. The antisocial personality does not evince the thought disorder patterns that are more easily discerned. There are few signs of anxiety, phobias, or delusions. He is, in essence, an emotional robot, programmed by himself to reflect the responses that he has found society demands. And because that programming is often so cunning, this personality is extremely hard to diagnose, nor can it be healed. My first niggling doubt about Ted's personality came when he forgave Meg so quickly for betraying him to the police. True, he had loved her to the extent he was capable of loving, and Meg had never humiliated him. He was the dominant partner in their relationship, and he had humiliated her again and again. But he never viewed her betrayal as an act of revenge on her part. I think she may have been the one woman in his life who helped to fill even a small corner of his barren soul. Although he could not be faithful to her, neither could he exist without her. And so, because he needed her so much, he seemed able to obliterate any vestiges of resentment toward her. Because it was essential to have her emotional support, he could forgive her for her weakness. But it was such a flat response, so eerily unhuman for him to be able to simply forget that it was Meg who had caused him to be caught. I am quite convinced that without Meg's interference, the identity of Ted would still be a mystery today. Ted's psyche so dominated Meg's that I am amazed that she was ever able to break free. And I don't know how free she is, even though she is married to another man. Sharon Auer was merely expedient. She was there in Utah when he needed someone to run errands or bring supplies into prison. But he left her behind when he left Point of the Mountain. Carol Ann Boone soon filled the gap. Ted has never been without a woman at his beck and call since his legal troubles began. Carol Boone has endured. She refers to him as Bunny and plainly adores him. I could not presume to evaluate what his feelings are for her. I talked at length to his other women. Carol Ann said only 5 words to me. As he told me, she has thrown in her lot with me. But it is certainly a blighted romance. There is, within all imperfect mechanisms, a tendency to self-destruct, as if the machine itself realizes that it is not functioning correctly. When the mechanism is a human being, those destructive forces ride their way to the surface from time to time. Somewhere, hidden deeply in the recesses of Ted's brain, there is a synapse of cells that is trying to destroy him. Perhaps that first Ted, the small child Ted who could have become all that was promised, knows that the Ted who has taken over must be done away with. Or is that too far-fetched? The fact remains that Ted has constantly struck out at the very people who have tried to defend him. Over and over he has fired his attorneys, sometimes within sight of victory. He chose the most dangerous state in the Union to flee to, knowing that the death penalty was a real threat there. Given a chance to plea bargain for his very life, he tore up the motion that would have saved him and virtually dared the state prosecutors to convict him, a challenge they were only too willing to accept. I think he wants to die. I don't know if he realizes that he does. In my opinion, Ted is not a Jekyll Hyde. I have no doubt at all that he remembers the murders. There may be some overlapping, some blurring, just as a man may not remember distinctly every woman he has ever slept with. How many times has he told me that he is able to put the bad things that have happened to him out of his mind? The memories may lie hidden like festering boils, but he does remember. The memories can no longer be left behind, because he has no place left to run, and they must haunt his cell in Rayford Prison. My own memory haunts me. The precognition of the dream, the nightmare I had in April of 1976, frightens me. Why did I dream that the baby I tried to save bit me? That dream where I saw the bite mark on my hand was 2 years before the bite mark on one of Ted's Chi Omega victims became the prime piece of physical evidence in the Miami trial. If only Ted had talked to me during our last meeting in Seattle in January of 1976, it might have been different. When he said, "There are things I want to tell you, but I can't," was there something I could have said that would have allowed him to talk to me then? Could I have changed any of the events that were to come? Although Ted insists he bears no guilt for any of the killings, I am sure there are many others who, like I, carry feelings of guilt because we should have known more, done more, before it was too late. Ted would have lived if he had confessed to me in the state of Washington. We had no death penalty here in 1974. He would have lived in the state of Colorado. The state of Florida will never let him go, not even to stand trial for Karen Campbell's murder in Colorado. Colorado let him escape twice, and Florida authorities are scornful of their security. Ted Bundy belongs to Florida. Killing Ted will accomplish nothing at all. All it would assure is that he could never kill again. But looking at the broken, confused man in the courtroom, I knew that Ted was insane. I cannot justify executing a man who is insane. Placing him in a mental institution with the tightest security possible could perhaps do more toward psychiatric research into the causes and hopefully cures for the antisocial personality than the evaluation of any other individual in history. It might save the potential victims of antisocial personality still being formed. Ted can never go free. He is dangerous, and he will always be dangerous. But there are answers to vital questions locked in his mind. I don't want him to die. If the day comes when he is led into the death chamber at Rayford Prison, I will cry. I will cry for that long-lost Ted Bundy who might have been, for the bright, warm young man I thought I knew so many years ago. It is still difficult for me to believe that the facade of kindness and caring I saw was only that, a thin veneer. There could have been, should have been, so much more. But if Ted is to die, I think he will muster the strength to do it with style, basking for the last time in the glow of strobe lights and television cameras. If he is relegated to the ranks of prisoners, the general population, that will be the worst punishment of all. If he is not killed by his fellow prisoners, who have been vocal that Bundy should fry, the emptiness inside himself will destroy him. When I grieve for Ted, and I do, I grieve for all the others who bear no guilt at all. Catherine Mary Devine is dead. Brenda Baker is dead. Joni Lenz is alive. Linda Ann Healy is dead. Donna Manson is gone. Susan Rancourt is dead. Roberta Kathleen Parks is dead. Brenda Ball is dead. George Ann Hawkins is gone. Janice Ott is dead. Denise Naslund is dead. Melissa Smith is dead. Laura Aim is dead. Carol DeRonch Swenson is alive. Debbie Kent is gone. Karen Campbell is dead. Julie Cunningham is gone. Denise Oliverson is gone. Shelley Robertson is dead. Melanie Cooley is dead. Lisa Levy is dead. Margaret Bowman is dead. Karen Chandler is alive. Kathy Kleiner DeShields is alive. Cheryl Thomas is alive. Kimberly Leach is dead. One day the earth and the rivers may give up more remains, all that is left of the young women whose names are still unknown. The women Ted referred to when he said, "Add one more digit to that and you'll have it." None of them could fill the hollow soul of Ted Bundy. Epilogue. The trials and hearings of Ted Bundy had become akin to a Broadway play, its long run ended, replaced by a road company. Only the star remained in the lead role, surrounded by a new cast. And the star was tired. He had lost much of his enthusiasm. Ted's trial in the Kimberly Leach case puzzled laymen. "How many times can you kill a man?" they asked incredulously. Since Ted Bundy had already been sentenced to death twice, they could not see the need for yet another trial. The state, of course, was covering its bets. If there should be a reversal on appeal in the Chi Omega killings, they wanted the backup of a third death sentence. Legally, it made sense. The Leach trial was postponed again and again, finally settling in Orlando, Florida on January 7, 1980. Orange County was a grudging host. They didn't want Ted or the hoopla that seemed to accompany him. But Judge Wallace Jopling, the 62-year-old jurist who would preside at the Leach trial, had determined he could not find an impartial jury in the Lake City area. The roster of attorneys had changed. Only Lynn Thompson remained of the original defense team. Thompson was joined by Julius Victor Africano, Jr. The man who might have defended Ted was Milo I. Thomas, public defender for the Third Judicial Circuit. But Thomas excused himself. He was a close friend of the Leach family. Jerry Blair of the state attorney's office, Jerry Blair who had vowed to himself in June of 1979 that if Ted wanted a trial, Ted would get a trial, and Bob Deckel, a down-home good old boy lawyer with a perpetual chaw of tobacco tucked in one cheek, a special prosecutor, would speak for the state. There was a pronounced malaise among the reporters who had covered the Miami trial. Nobody really wanted to go through a second trial. Tony Polk of the Rocky Mountain News wasn't going. A Seattle reporter had to go on assignment, but he dreaded it. A Miami reporter called me and said, "Yeah, I'm going, but not until I have to. I'm just going up for the kill." And then he gasped and said, "God, that sounds awful, doesn't it? But it's the only way to describe it." I didn't go. I knew what the evidence was. I knew what the witnesses were going to say, and I could not bear to see Ted again in the state he had come to. Instead, I watched the Orlando trial on television and saw a man who might well have been a complete stranger to me. Ted was no longer as handsome as he'd been at the Miami trial. His weight hovered near 190 pounds, his jowls bulged, and his eyes were sunken. The lean, cleanly defined good looks were gone, along with his tenuous grasp of reality. He flared with temper easily and seemed about to blow into fragmented pieces. He took offense when a court stenographer, a woman who smiled naturally, appeared to him to be making light of the proceedings. "Would you please take this seriously?" he shouted at her. But no one seemed to take it seriously. They had come to see the show. A local disc jockey had set the tone of the trial by opening his morning broadcast with, "Watch out, girls, Ted Bundy's in town." A female impersonator from Pennsylvania made a dramatic entrance, swirling his fake leopard jacket and tossing his platinum wig as he sashayed to a seat. Ted never looked up. A young man removed his jacket to reveal a T-shirt reading, "Send Bundy to Iran." And in the front row were the ever-present Ted groupies, anxious for a smile from the fading star. The television camera might as well have focused on the inmates of Bedlam. Neither Louise or Johnny Bundy made the trip back to Florida. There was only Carol Ann Boone sitting beside the wife of an inmate from Rayford. Carol Ann still flashing Ted looks of love and encouragement. The prospective jurors, available from a seemingly endless pool, appeared willing to say almost anything so that they might be chosen. Judge Jopling had ruled that even those potential jurors who believed Ted guilty might be chosen if they indicated they could put aside their opinions and remain objective. Several of those prospective venirimen made the jury. There was nowhere else in Florida where the trial could go. Prosecutor Blair said a change in venue would be an exercise in futility. "This man is a cause celebre here, and he would be a cause celebre in Two-Egg, Pahokee, or Sop Choppy as well." Twice Ted stalked out of the courtroom, a demonstration against the jury being seated. "I'm leaving. This is a game, and I won't be a party to it. I'm not staying in this kind of Waterloo, you understand?" Returned and calmed down until he had a modicum of control, he blew up again, slamming his hand on Judge Jopling's desk. "You want a circus?" he cried to Blair. "I'll make a circus. I'll rain on your parade, Jack. You'll see a thunderstorm." Ted headed for the door, and a bailiff blocked his way. Ted set down the beer carton he carried his files in on a railing and removed his jacket. The television camera caught, for the first time, a Ted Bundy out of control. He was back to the wall, a snarling fox caught in a circle of hunters. It may have been the face contorted with open-mouthed rage that his victims had seen, and it shocked me. He appeared to be about to come out swinging at the five court officers who surrounded him. He stood panting, trapped. A moment passed. Two. Ted and his tormentors were frozen.
"Sit down, Mr. Bundy," Jopling ordered.
"You know how far you can push me. Sit down, Mr. Bundy."
Slowly he came back to himself. Slumped, all the fight gone out of him. He walked back to the defense table and slid into his chair, eyes downcast.
"It's no use," he stage whispered to Africano. "We've lost the jury. There's no point in playing the game."
He may well have been right. Day after day, Ted sat in confusion and anger as 65 prosecution witnesses took the stand. Africano and Thompson fought it all, digging their heels in for some kind of foothold as they were forced back and back. This time they would not allow Ted himself to speak, although he was allowed to participate in legal arguments away from the jurors' ears. 3 weeks into the trial, Ted made a 20-minute plea for acquittal in Jopling's chambers. His voice quavering, He seemed on the edge of tears as his monologue drifted, a far cry from his ordered, precise arguments in Utah 4 years earlier. He insisted that there was no evidence that a murder had even been committed. The defense presented two witnesses who had allegedly seen Kimberly Leach hitchhiking near Jimmy's Buttermilk Chicken Place on the morning she disappeared. But they faltered when asked to identify her picture absolutely as that of the girl they'd seen 2 years before. Even the testimony of Atlanta medical examiner Dr. Joseph Burton backfired. He had apparently been retained to bolster the defense claim that Kimberly Leach could have died of other causes, and he clearly could not do that.
While my study of findings could not rule out accidental, suicidal, or natural causes, all three were way down on the list.
On February 6th, the most startling rumors in the courthouse concerned Carol Ann Boone. Ms. Boone had applied for a marriage license. Whether there was any way she could indeed marry the man she called Bunny was questionable. Major Jim Schultz, County Director of Corrections, was adamant that there would be no wedding in his jail. But Judge Jopling authorized a blood test for Ted to fulfill an initial requirement for the license. Carol Ann admitted that she fully expected Ted to be convicted, but she was determined to marry him anyway. The odds were not on the chance of acquittal. Spectators were betting on whether Ted and Carol Ann could get married. Ted himself had bet Africano that the jury would find him guilty in 3 hours. He lost. They took 7.5 hours, a half hour more than the Miami jury had. This time there was no weeping mother begging for her perfect son. There was only Carol Ann Boone. It was 2 years to the day since 12-year-old Kimberly Leach had vanished, February 9th, 1980. Carol Ann took the stand to plead for Ted's life. But first and seemingly foremost, she had a mission. She wanted to become Mrs. Ted Bundy. She had meticulously researched how one got married in Florida, given the peculiar circumstances. She knew that public declaration, properly phrased, in an open courtroom in the presence of court officers would make the ceremony legal. A notary public, holding the marriage license in the names of Carol Ann Boone and Theodore Robert Bundy, sat watching as Ted rose to question his fiancée. The bride wore not white, but black, a skirt and sweater over an open-necked blouse. The groom, who had always favored bow ties, wore one with blue polka dots and a blue sports jacket. The jury wore looks of utter bemusement. The couple smiled at each other as if they were the only two people in the courtroom, as he began to question her formally.
Where do you reside?
I am a permanent resident of Seattle, Washington.
Could you explain when you met me, how long you have known me, our relationship? He said, leading her.
Carol continued to smile happily as she recalled their meeting in Olympia at the Department of Emergency Services office. Of the closeness they had achieved as Ted's legal problems increased.
Several years ago, our relationship evolved into a more serious romantic sort of thing.
Is it serious?
Ted asked.
Serious enough that I want to marry him, she said to the jury.
Can you tell the jury if you've ever observed any violent or destructive tendencies in my character or personality?
I've never seen anything in Ted that indicates any destructiveness towards any other people, and I've been associated with Ted in virtually every circumstance. He's been involved with my family. I've never seen anything in Ted that indicates any kind of destructiveness, any kind of hostility. He's a warm, kind, patient man.
Over the prosecution's objections, Carol Ann stated that she felt it was not correct for either an individual or a representative of the state to take the life of another human being. She turned toward the jury and spoke with an intensity.
Ted is a large part of my life. He is vital to me.
Do you want to marry me? Ted asked.
Yes.
I do want to marry you, Ted said, as the state lawyers and Judge Jopling froze with surprise.
It took Dekel and Blair a few beats before they were able to rise and object. Ted turned to confer with his attorneys. He'd almost blown it. He'd used the wrong terminology. They told him marriage was a contract, not a promise. He would have one more chance on redirect to make his verbal contract. State Attorney Blair questioned Carol Ann, suggesting that there might be a less romantic reason than true love behind her desire to marry Ted. He hinted that there might be financial reasons, but Carol remained unmoved. He questioned the timing of the proposal, coming as it did just as a jury was about to deliberate on the death penalty. Carol Ann would not be shaken. As Blair cross-examined her, Ted conferred frantically with his lawyers. He rose to question her on redirect. This time he knew what he was supposed to say to be sure the marriage was valid.
"Will you marry me?" Ted asked Carol Ann.
"Yes,"
she replied with a giggle and a broad smile.
"Then I do hereby marry you."
Ted grinned expansively. It was done before the prosecutors realized it. Carol Ann and her bunny were now man and wife. Most of the eyes in the courtroom were decidedly dry, and there would be no honeymoon. The second anniversary of Kimberly Leach's death was now Ted Bundy's wedding day. Carol Ann had prevailed. She had remained loyal and omnipresent. Stephanie, Meg, and Sharon were now relegated to Ted's dim past. One got the impression that Carol Ann's tenacity was such that she might indeed wrest Ted from the very arms of the electric chair if it came to that. And it seemed that it would come to that. After listening to Jerry Blair's characterization of the wedding as a little Valentine's Day charade, and to Ted's own 40-minute rambling plea for his life, the jury retired for 45 minutes to deliberate on the question of the death penalty. It was 3:20 p.m. on February 9th when they announced their decision that Ted must die. He rose in his chair and shouted, "Tell the jury they were wrong!" On February 12th, Judge Jopling sentenced Ted to die, for the third time, in the electric chair in Rayford Prison. As Ted stood to receive that sentence, he carried a red envelope in his hand, a valentine for his bride. Within an hour, Ted was in a helicopter lifting off the courthouse roof, headed back to Rayford Prison. In the language of Florida state law, he had been convicted once again of a crime extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile. There would be appeals ahead, predicted to take years, but for all intents and purposes, the Ted Bundy story was over. Locked away from the rays of the limelight, the rays that for Ted seem necessary to sustain life, I know that he will continue to sink deeper and deeper into the compulsive madness that grips him. He will never again be the golden boy beloved by the media. Ted Bundy is a killer, a 3 times convicted killer, a throwaway man now. I cannot forget his phone call in October 1975, the call where he said calmly, "I'm in a little trouble, but it's all going to work out. If anything goes wrong, you'll read about it in the newspapers." Afterward. As I write this, it has been 6 years since Ted Bundy was sentenced for the third time to die in Florida's electric chair. In my naivete in 1980, I ended The Stranger Beside Me by suggesting that the Ted Bundy story was at last over. It was not. I vastly underestimated Ted's ability to regenerate in both spirit and body, to pit his will and mind continually against the justice system. Nor was I able to extricate Ted from my mind simply by putting him and my feelings about him on paper. The relief that I felt when I wrote the last line was immense. This book was a healing catharsis after a half dozen years of horror. But the next half dozen years have forced me to accept that some significant part of my consciousness will be inhabited by Ted Bundy and his crimes for as long as I live. I have written 5 books since The Stranger Beside Me. And yet when my phone rings or a letter comes from somewhere far away, several times a week still, the questions are invariably about the Ted book. My correspondents fall generally into 4 categories. Laymen have contacted me from as far away as Greece, South Africa, the Virgin Islands, consumed with curiosity about Ted Bundy's eventual fate. Most of them ask, when was he executed? Police investigators call wondering where Ted Bundy might have been on a particular date. Ted's comments to Pensacola detectives that February night he was captured in 1978 are well remembered by homicide detectives all over America. Although officially a murder suspect in only 5 states, Ted told Detective Norm Chapman and Don Patchen that he had killed in 6 states and that they should add 1 digit to the FBI's victim estimate of 36. The calls that surprised me most were from Ted's burgeoning fan club, unofficial but passionately vocal. So many young women who had fallen in love with Ted Bundy and who wanted to know how they could contact him to let him know how much they loved him. When I explained that he had married Carol Ann Boone, my words fell on deaf ears. I finally asked him to read my book once more, asking, "Are you sure that you can tell the difference between a teddy bear and a fox?" Almost as fervent were the religious readers who hoped to get word to Ted so that they might prevail upon him to repent before it was too late. Finally, there were the callers that Seattle policemen refer to as 220s, people deranged to greater and lesser degrees, who imagined that they had some bizarre connection to Ted. The latter were the most difficult to deal with. An elderly woman came to my door near midnight, regal and impeccably dressed, and yet distressed because Ted Bundy has been stealing my nylons and my pantyhose. He's been coming into my house since 1948, and he takes my personal files. He's very clever. He puts everything back so that you can scarcely tell it's been moved. It did no good to point out that her thefts had begun when Ted was still a toddler. Her visit did, however, make me realize that I could no longer have my home address printed in the phone book. In ways that I could never have imagined, Ted Bundy changed my life. I have flown 200,000 miles, lectured 1,000 times to groups ranging from ladies' book study clubs to defense attorneys' organizations to police training seminars to the FBI Academy, always about Ted. Some questions are easy enough for me to answer. Some may never be answered, and some provoke more and more questions in an endless continuum. If indeed Ted claimed to have murdered in 6 states, then which state was the 6th? Had there really been a 6th state, 136 victims, or, God help us, 360 victims? Or had it been for Ted a game to play with his interrogators in Pensacola? His cunning jousts with police were always akin to Dungeons and Dragons, and he so delighted in outwitting them, watching them scurry around to do what he considered his bidding. There may well have been myriad other victims, and yet it is an almost impossible task to deduce precisely where Ted Bundy was on a particular date in the late 60s and early 70s. I have tried to isolate periods of that time almost 20 years ago now, and so has Bob Keppel, the one-time King County detective who knows as much about Ted as any cop in America. But Ted was always a traveler, and an impulsive wanderer at that. He would say he was going one place and head somewhere else. He hated to be made accountable for his whereabouts by anyone, and he reveled in popping up to surprise those who knew him. 1969 found Ted visiting relatives in Arkansas and attending classes at Temple University in Philadelphia, his childhood home. In 1969, a beautiful, dark-haired young woman was stabbed to death far back in the stacks of the library at Temple. That case, more than a decade unsolved, came back to a Pennsylvania homicide detective when he traced Ted's journeys in my book. In the end, he could only conjecture. No one could place Ted in that library on that evening. Even more haunting is the unsolved murder of Rita Curran in Burlington, Vermont on July 19, 1971. Each born in Burlington, Rita Curran and Ted Bundy were 24 years old that summer. Ted had, of course, been raised on the opposite coast while Rita grew up in the tiny community of Milton, Vermont, daughter of the town's zoning administrator. Rita was a very lovely but shy young woman. Her dark hair fell midway down her back. Sometimes she parted it on the left side, sometimes in the middle. A graduate of Burlington's Trinity College, she taught second grade at the Milton Elementary School during the school year. Like Linda Ann Healy, Rita spent much of her time and energy working with deprived and handicapped children. Although she was well into her 20s, she hadn't really lived away from home until the summer of 1971. She had worked as a chambermaid at the Colonial Motor Inn in Burlington for 3 previous summers, but this year was the first she'd taken an apartment there rather than commuting from her parents' Milton home 10 miles north. She was attending classes in teaching remedial reading and language at the University of Vermont's Graduate School, and shared the apartment on Brooks Avenue with a female roommate. Rita Curran had no steady boyfriend, and that was probably one of her reasons for spending the summer in Burlington. She was hoping to meet a man who would be right for her. She wanted to be married, to have children of her own. And she laughed to friends. I've gone to 3 weddings this year. All the bachelors in Milton are taken. On Monday, July 19, 1971, Rita changed bedding and vacuumed rooms at the Colonial Motor Inn from 8:15 a.m. to 2:40 p.m. That evening, she rehearsed with her barbershop quartet until 10. Rita Curran's roommate and a friend left her in the apartment on Brooks at 11:20 to go to a restaurant. Both the front and back doors were unlocked when they left. Burlington, Vermont was hardly a high-crime area. People didn't lock doors. When Rita's friends returned, the apartment was quiet, and they assumed she had gone to sleep. They talked for an hour, and then Rita's roommate walked into the bedroom. Rita Curran lay nude, murdered. She had been strangled manually, beaten savagely on the left side of the head, and raped. Her torn underpants were beneath her body. Her purse, contents intact, was nearby. Burlington detectives traced the escape route of the killer and found a small patch of blood near the back door leading off the kitchen. He had, perhaps, dashed through the kitchen and out through the shed beyond, even as Rita's roommate came in the front door. A canvas of neighbors was fruitless. No one had heard a scream or a struggle. In 1971, there were approximately 10,000 homicides in America. What intrigued John Bassett, a retired FBI special agent and also a native of Burlington, when he read about Ted Bundy, was the remarkable resemblance between Rita Curran and Stephanie Brooks, the fact that Rita had died of strangulation and bludgeoning to the head, and the proximity of the Colonial Motor Inn where Rita worked to an institution that had wrought so much emotional trauma in Ted Bundy's life, the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers. The Lund home was right next door to the motel. I had always assumed that Ted's trip to Burlington had occurred in the summer of 1969 when he journeyed east. But John Bassett's call made me wonder. It was in the fall of 1971 when Ted spoke to me of finding out who I really was. If Ted was in Burlington in July of 1971, if he walked past the building where he was born, if he perhaps even checked into the Colonial Motor Inn, there are no records whatsoever to confirm or deny it. There is only a blurred notation in the Burlington dog catcher's records that note a person named Bundy had been bitten by a dog that week. In talking with Bassett, with Rita Curran's parents, and with the detective from the Burlington Police Department, I too was fascinated by so many similarities, but there was little I could do to confirm their suspicions about Ted Bundy. Meg Anders writes in her book, The Phantom Prince, that she saw Ted sometimes that summer. And sometimes he didn't show up for dates. She had begun to notice a moodiness in him. But was Ted gone long enough to make a trip to Vermont? And is it simply too easy to imagine Ted Bundy's shadow wherever a beautiful dark-haired woman died by strangulation and blows to the left side of the head? There are many commonalities between Rita Curran's murder and those that came later and were attributed to Ted. How many victims were there for Ted Bundy? Will we ever know? A dozen or more young women have called me since 1980, absolutely convinced that they had escaped from Ted Bundy. In San Francisco, in Georgia, in Idaho, in Aspen, in Ann Arbor, in Utah. He could not have been everywhere, but for these women there are terrified memories of a handsome man in a tan Volkswagen, a man who gave them a ride and who wanted more. They are sure that it was Ted who reached for them and declared that they never hitchhiked again. For other women, there is a man with a brilliant smile who came to their door, ingratiating and then angry when they would not let him in. It was him. I've seen his picture and I recognized him. Mass hysteria? I think yes, for most. For some, I wonder. There have been other calls that left no doubt in my mind. Lisa Wick, nearing 40 now, called me. Lisa was the stewardess who survived a bludgeoning with a 2x4 as she slept in a basement apartment on Queen Anne Hill in Seattle in the summer of 1966. Her roommate, Lonnie Trumbull, died. Like so many of the later victims who were struck again and again on the head as they slept, Lisa Wick lost weeks of memory forever. Lisa did not call to tell me that she had read my book. She called to say that she could not read my book. I try to pick it up and read it, but it is impossible. When my hand touches the cover, When I look at his eyes, I get sick to my stomach. Somewhere buried in her deepest forbidden memory, Lisa Wick knows that she has seen those eyes before. But long after her physical injuries have healed, her mind remains bruised and protects itself. I know that it was Ted Bundy who did that to us, but I can't tell you how I know. There have been no calls from Anne Marie Burr, who would be 31 if she was alive. From the night she disappeared from her own home in Tacoma in August of 1962, there has been no sign of Anne Marie. And yet, I have had more calls, with information and with questions about Anne Marie than any of the other victims. A young woman whose brother was Ted Bundy's best boyhood friend.
We lived right across the street from the Bundys, and when that little girl disappeared, the police were all over our street. They searched the woods up at the end of the street many times. They questioned everybody because we lived so close to the Burr's house.
An older woman now living in a retirement home who lived near the Burrs in 1962.
He was the paper boy, Ted was, the morning paper boy. That little girl, Anne Marie, used to follow him around like a puppy. She really thought he was something. They knew each other all right. She would have gone with him if he asked her to crawl out the window.
It is so long ago, 24 years. A young woman called from Florida one day. An assistant in the state attorney general's office.
I'm a Chi Omega, she began, and I read your book.
I was a Chi Omega too, I said, and she interrupted.
No, I mean I was a Chi O at Florida State. I was there in Tallahassee that night, in the house when he got in.
We talked about how it could have happened with all those girls, 39 of them, and a house mother. How could anyone have done so much damage so quietly in such a short time?
He had already scouted it out that afternoon, I think, she mused. For some reason, we were all gone Saturday afternoon, even the house mother. The house was empty for a couple of hours. When we came home, the house mother's cat was acting spooked, and its hair was standing on end. It ran through our legs and out the door, and it didn't come back for 2 weeks.
She said some of the girls had felt the presence of a kind of evil that night. The Chi O's had wondered only a little while about the cat's behavior, but later that night, at least two of the girls who were upstairs in the sleeping area had experienced stark terror, a free-floating dread with nothing to pin it to.
Kim had a sore throat and she went to bed early. She got up sometime during the night to go down to the bathroom to get a drink of water because she was coughing. She saw that the lights were out in the hallway. They were almost always on, and it was pitch dark, but she just had a little way to walk to touch the switch. But she said she suddenly felt such unreasoning terror, as if something awful was waiting for her. She had a terrible cough and she really needed a drink of water, but she backed into her room and locked the door. She didn't come out until the police banged on the door later. And, it must have been a little bit after that, Tina started down the back stairs to the kitchen to get a snack. It was the same kind of thing. She couldn't seem to make her feet go down those stairs. She started to shake, and she ran back to her room, too. She'd felt something or someone waiting down below.
I had always believed that Margaret Bowman had been Ted's designated victim that January night in 1978. Margaret looked very much like Stephanie Brooks. She was a beautiful girl with the same long, silken dark hair. It would have been easy enough for Ted to have spotted her on the Florida State campus, or walking near the Oak in the Chi O house, or even at Sherrod's. But how could Ted have known which room Margaret Bowman slept in? I asked my Chi Omega caller that. How did he know just where to go?
We had a room plan posted.
A room plan?
Like a blueprint of the house. Each room had a number, and the names of the girls who had that room were written in.
Where was it?
In the foyer, near the front door on the wall there. We took it down after.
Posted on the foyer wall, right there in the one area of the sorority house where dates and delivery men, and strangers, could read it and pinpoint exactly which room each girl occupied. It would have been propitious for a man stalking a particular girl. The Chi Omegas, besieged by the press, ousted from their rooms by investigators dusting for prints, gathering evidence, and testing for blood, were evacuated from the huge house on West Jefferson and farmed out around Tallahassee with alumni. They came back 2 weeks later, just about the same time the house mother's cat deemed the house safe again.
I have not been back to the Kaio House in Tallahassee, but I have returned many times to the Theta House on the University of Washington campus in Seattle, with screenwriters or magazine photographers who want to see where Georgianne Hawkins vanished. It looks the same, the alley behind Greek Row with students constantly moving back and forth. Night or day, fraternity boys are still shooting basketballs at hoops nailed to telephone poles. The cars parked along there are newer models than those in the police photos. But otherwise, nothing has changed, not even the sorority itself that was Georgianne's destination. But when one considers an extrasensory awareness of danger or evil, I know I felt it in the narrow space between the Theta House and the fraternity just to the south of it. On the hottest, sunniest days, the air is icy. The pine trees there are crippled and blunted, and I want very much to be away from it, from the cement steps where Georgianne was to have perched while she threw pebbles at her roommate's window. Fear made some of Georgianne's sorority sisters drop out of school for a time. A dozen years later, Georgianne Hawkins is still missing. The sorority girls inside the Theta House seem oblivious to what happened to her. They were only 5 or 6 in 1974. For them, Georgianne Hawkins might well have vanished in the 1950s. Ted Bundy's rooming house on 12th and E looks exactly the same as it did the day he moved out and headed for Salt Lake City. The old rooming house, the next block over, where the woman was raped by a man in a dark watch cap, has been raised to make room for the University of Washington's new law school buildings. Farther north on 12th and E, the greenhouse where Linda Ann Healy disappeared in 1974 has been painted a dull brown. The main floor is a preschool now, and in the front window,